Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Wall Street again bumping into Washington, and a looming decision now for President Trump on what to do, whether to join Israel offensively against Iran. He's back at the White House today, as we told you, having left the G7 in Canada early to deal with these matters. And we've seen a flurry of posts on Truth Social demanding unconditional surrender in one case to Iran, and going even further to write about Iran's supreme leader. We know exactly, he writes, where the so-called supreme leader is hiding. He is an easy target, but is safe there. We're not going to take him out. He writes, kill in parentheses, at least not for now. But we don't want missiles shot at civilians or American soldiers. Our patience is wearing thin. Thank you for your attention to this matter. The question, of course, whether the U.S. should go further than providing logistical support to the Israeli military, the Israeli Air Force, the IDF, whether, in fact, the U.S. should put American air crews in B-2 bombers to deliver bunker-busting bombs that are needed to get to the deep underground enrichment facilities like Fordo that we've talked about inside Iran. I discussed the idea of U.S. involvement and whether it was essential right at this time yesterday in a conversation with Ron Dermer, Israel's Minister for Strategic Affairs. Here's what he said.
The U.S. has been tremendous in the support that it's given Israel from the beginning of this war on defense. There is an understanding, frankly, Joe, in America, and not just Israel, that when we are fighting Iran, we're not just fighting for ourselves. We're fighting an enemy of the United States. So when we're taking them on, we are fighting your fight. And it actually, our victory will also be an American victory. And I think it will help turn the region into a different direction.
Let's see what the thinking is at the White House right now. Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall has been there all day and joins us live from the North Lawn. Tyler?
Yeah, hey, Joe. Well, it's our understanding that the U.S. has been in close contact with its Israeli counterparts. President Trump has been in the Situation Room getting updates. And then about an hour ago, as you mentioned, we saw this flurry of posts on Truth Social that included him posting about unconditional surrender and also threatening Iran's supreme leader. And then another one worth reiterating. He said, quote, "We now have complete and total control of the skies over Iran. Iran had good sky trackers and other defensive equipment and plenty of it, but it doesn't compare to American-made, conceived, and manufactured stuff," in quotes. This definitely, of course, heightens the U.S.'s support of these ongoing Israeli airstrikes, as the question really does become, what will U.S. involvement look like going forward? We could soon have an answer, as Axios reports that President Trump is going to convene that National Security Council at 1 p.m. Eastern. And we also heard from the German chancellor speaking to local broadcaster, saying that the U.S. will make its decision based off of whether or not it thinks Iran is willing to negotiate. We should say that up to this point, the White House has maintained that it has a defensive posture here, though it did move military assets into the region. And analysts do tell us, just for context, that if the U.S. does get involved, it likely wouldn't be boots on the ground, troops on the ground, but it would be air or sea defense and support moving forward there. Also important to mention, though, that the speculation about this, Joe, really did heighten after we saw a post from Vice President J.D. Vance earlier today. He wrote in a post on X that President Trump, quote, "may decide he needs to take further action to end Iranian enrichment." Of course, the possibility of a diplomatic de-escalation could still be on the table. It's worth noting that President Trump did suggest earlier that he may dispatch either Vance or his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, for talks with Iran. We're just waiting for some updates on how that evolves.
All right, Tyler, stay close with us. Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall at the White House as we turn our attention now to what is left of the G7 summit in Canada. Bloomberg's David Gura is in Banff, where world leaders are continuing to move their conversations ahead, even without President Trump. David, how is all of this playing there?
Well, to borrow a phrase from the president, this matter does have the attention of the world leaders who are gathered here. We heard from Chancellor Friedrich Merz of Germany this morning talking about that conflict, having some very strong rhetoric about Iran and suggesting that the U.S. is going to make its decision on military action today. So everyone here tracking very closely what's happening in Washington, indeed what's happening in the Middle East as well. But as you rightfully point out, Joe, The agenda proceeds as normal. President Volodymyr Zelensky is here in Canada. He had a meeting with Prime Minister Mark Carney just a few minutes ago, at which Canada announced a big investment in defense spending for Ukraine and new sanctions on Russia. We're seeing those meetings continue over the course of the day. And sitting in President Trump's seat at all of these major meetings is now Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, who traveled here with President Trump with the expectation going into this summit there would be more conversations on the sidelines about trade and tariffs. But he has now been kind of given the imprimatur to sit in that seat over the course of these meetings to kind of play the role of the U.S.'s representative here as conversations center on Ukraine this morning and energy this afternoon. Again, the official agenda continues, but everyone here very much watching what's unfolding in Washington in the Middle East, Joe.
Great reporting this week from David Gura live in Banff, Canada. Thank you so much, David, as we add the voice of experience in retired General Frank McKenzie. We told you he would join us, someone with answers to many of the questions that we've been asking, as he was the former commander, United States Central Command, CENTCOM, from 2019 to 2022. Now Executive Director of the University of South Florida's Global and National Security Institute. General McKenzie, it's good to have you back on Balance of Power. Welcome back to Bloomberg TV and radio. It's good to have you with us. The president is facing a big choice today, as it seems, and he's been writing on Truth Social about it. If you were still in your old job, would you recommend to the president that the U.S. join Israel offensively in eliminating Iran's nuclear program?
Well, I think, first of all, it's good to be with you, Joe. I think the important thing to remember here is as he approaches this decision, President Trump actually has unique credibility with Iran because he gave the order to strike Qasem Soleimani back in early 2020. So he possesses enormous wasta, if you will, as he approaches this problem. It's going to be his decision to choose how is he going to use it. Are we going to try to negotiate now? The problem with negotiating with the Iranians is they're not great fighters, but they're remarkable negotiators. They will try to bog you down. They'll try to spin it out in time. And what they will try to do is stay on their task of destroying Israel and ejecting us from the region. So it's a particularly difficult decision for the president to make. If we go in and we strike this target, as we're talking about doing, we're probably not going to be able to completely eradicate the Iranian nuclear program, but we will set the nuclear program back.
Interesting. You mentioned Qasem Soleimani. I believe you did recommend to President Trump at the time that he be taken out. And a lot of people are looking at that as the beginning of a saga that brings us here today, that in fact closing the deal at Fordow and eliminating, by the use of American B-2 bombers and the MOAB, eliminating what is left of that enrichment facility would be the bookend on something that you started that day, General. Is that correct?
Well, that would be President Trump's decision to actually execute that strike. And I believe you can make a point that it began a narrative arc that has taken us to where we are today. You know, 2024 was the worst year in Iranian history in terms of foreign policy and defense policy. But it really did begin with the loss of Soleimani, who was their inspirational leader, the guy that could bring it all together for him across the region. After January 2020, he was no longer there, and they have felt his loss significantly.
It's really interesting as we try to understand the impact that had when it comes to communications with Iran's proxies, when it comes even to esprit de corps, if I can use that term, in keeping some cohesion among proxies and even within the Revolutionary Guard. The elimination of Qasem Soleimani speaks directly to the chaos and the lack of response, the chaotic response we're seeing now, does it not?
It absolutely does. The fact of the matter is the Iranian military, and particularly the IRGC, the Republican Guard Corps, they don't have good succession planning. People come into these jobs and they stay for many, many, many years. You know, you don't have someone you can turn to if a person dies or is killed. And they felt that very keenly. They felt it in the loss of Soleimani. We see it right now in the loss of their equivalent of their chairman and equivalent in the loss of the IRGC commander. It is having a profound effect on Iranian decision making. It's crippling it. It's making it very hard for them to come to coordinated positions on how to respond. And we see that every day in their ineptitude.
General McKenzie, we're getting headlines from Iranian state media right now that Iran will soon launch what they're calling a punitive operation against Israel. I'm reading these with you for the first time, citing Iran's chief of staff of armed forces on this operation, urging Israelis to evacuate Tel Aviv and Haifa. How should Israel respond to headlines like these? And is the Iron Dome enough to keep them safe?
The waves of Iranian attacks have had minimal success. I know that's easy for me to say here in the United States when buildings have been destroyed in Israel, but the Israeli success rate with their various systems far beyond Iron Dome has actually been pretty remarkable. The Iranians have thrown about all they can throw at Israel. There's not some secret deadly weapon out there waiting to be employed. They just don't have it. You'll see more of the same against Israel. I predict what will happen over time is that Israeli defenses will grow increasingly effective as they solve the way the Iranians are attacking. And the Iranians don't have an endless supply of these weapons as well.
We've been surging equipment into the theater, as I'm sure you know, more than two dozen tankers, air-to-air refuelers. We're steering the USS Nimitz strike carrier group into the region. What does this collection of material illustrate to you that we may be preparing for?
First of all, it illustrates the excellence of the joint force, and our capabilities are global. We can flex anywhere very quickly. I think it's prudent planning by the Department of Defense. It's all about giving the president options. The decision to whether or not we're going to strike Iran is going to be a political decision. That is not a military decision. But what you want to do is ensure that the president has all the tools necessary to make that decision or to defer that decision if that's what he wants to do and protect our forces in the region. And so that's what's going on right now. It's pretty much another day at the office for the U.S. military. We're very good at this. Yeah. They're bringing them in so that we can prepare for really any contingency.
Some great reporting today in the New York Times about what it would take to strike Fordow, the underground enrichment site that we've already referred to. It's essentially underneath a mountain, General. And apparently the U.S. was involved here, the Pentagon, for several years trying to refine a strike plan if, in fact, it was needed. They found that it would require B-2s, several of them, releasing one MOAB after another down the same hole before they got there. Were you involved in those experiments? Is that actually what it would take, regardless of whether it's decided to be used today? Is that what it would take to blow up a mountain?
So really, Joe, all I can tell you is we have very good plans. We have very good capabilities. We've studied the problem. We believe we have a solution to the problem. But that's really all I can tell you.
Well, when the general can't answer a question like that, I know we're getting warm on something here. Let me ask you further. There's also reporting that if we didn't, in fact, make that decision to use these bunker-busting bombs, that cutting the power might do it. A sabotage mission to cut the power to these centrifuges, which spin at supersonic speeds. Should that be in our playbook?
Every possible approach to this problem is in our playbook, and many of them are obviously also in Israel's playbook. Everything from different forms of cyber attack to power interruption to proxy attack direct on the ground. All of those options are on the table. All of those options have been thoroughly studied, and all of those options would be available should we choose to use them.
As we spend time with retired General Frank McKenzie trying to figure out the way forward here, I wonder the questions that you're asking as well about how far Israel is planning to go here, General. Is there a scenario that we should be prepared for that would involve Israeli boots on the ground in Iran and a very different mission to support?
Joe, I can't see that under any circumstance. Iran's a large country with a population of over 90 million. I can't see any possible way that would involve an Israeli ground invasion of Iran. Just not going to happen. I see some scenarios perhaps where the Israelis believe they can knock out the existing government. You're dealing with what is essentially a failed state, a dysfunctional entity. And in some ways, that may be better than a state that isn't failing, but that has malevolent intent, not only against Israel, but against all of its neighbors. It would not be a good scenario for the people of Iran, who will be denied basic services for food, for medicine, for all the things that make life worth living. But to some degree, the only people to blame for that is current Iranian leadership.
General, you know what it's like to be in the Situation Room with the National Security Council, with the President of the United States. It appears that's the kind of day they're having today at the White House. We've already discussed the decision that President Trump is facing here. And I wonder if we could qualify this as the most important foreign policy decision facing a president since the withdrawal of Afghanistan.
It's certainly a big decision. And if you're in there as a military person, your job is to ensure that the people who make those decisions, the civilian leadership of our country, have all the options they need in order to execute whatever decision they choose. And then the joint force will faithfully execute those decisions.
There seems to be an expectation this decision is made today, General. How long is this window open for?
I think we have some flexibility in how we choose to approach it. I think the problem is for the Iranians, time works against them. They're weaker every day. They're more attrited every day. They're less capable every day. So I think the pressure, the clock is working against them. It's working for us and for Israel.
Lastly, the president writing on Truth Social, General, you might have seen it. We know exactly where the so-called supreme leader is hiding, he writes. An easy target. He's safe there. We're not going to take him out, at least for now. Is the supreme leader eventually a target?
Don't know the answer to that. I do know that President Trump has unique credibility when he writes those words, and Iran is very much aware of that.
It's great to have you with us, General. We hope that we can continue this conversation with you. Retired General Frank McKenzie, former CENTCOM commander, now at the University of South Florida's Global and National Security Institute. A fascinating conversation, as we always seek to bring you voices of experience, practitioners here on Balance of Power. We'll assemble our panel next. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano are with us live from Washington with much more to follow here. I'm Joe Matthew, and glad you're along on the Tuesday edition of Balance of Power on Bloomberg TV and radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Watching the Tuesday trade evolve with the news here from Washington, Bloomberg News can now confirm the president of the United States set to meet with the national security team here to talk about what next in the Middle East. We've had a flurry of Truth Social posts from President Trump, and as we were just discussing with retired General Frank McKenzie, a big decision here in the offing, and it could come today based on everything that we are hearing about what should be the U.S. policy when it comes to offensive military action against Iran. The president calling for unconditional surrender in one Truth Social post, going even further, if you were with us on Bloomberg, to say we know exactly where the so-called supreme leader is hiding, adding that we're not going to take him out, at least not for now. The pressure campaign is ratcheting up here as we get closer to a decision that could lead to either U.S. military action or some sort of deal, if we're still allowing for that. We assembled our political panel now. Bloomberg Politics contributors Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis are with us. Rick is our Republican strategist partner at Stone Court Capital. Jeannie is senior democracy fellow with the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. Rick, you spent enough time at the White House and in skiffs across Washington to have a sense of what this is like inside the sit room, inside the West Wing right now. Give us a sense of the conversations that are being had, the options the president is hearing, and from whom.
Yeah, well, the Joint Chiefs' job is to advise the president and give him military options, obviously orchestrated by his Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth. So they are there along with the national security team, both inside the White House and other members in the cabinet. And that is exactly, Joe, what you described they're doing. They're going through various scenarios, to tell the president what kind of options he has, what kind of choices, answering any questions that he or the team has, and game planning out a little bit about what happens next. We know he's not tweeting in there because you're not allowed to have a phone in a skiff, certainly not in a sit room. And so he must have, we can almost time how much time he's in the sit room by like when those tweets kick off again, and gets his phone back. But the bottom line on it is that they'll have all the information they need there at hand, a lot of electronic information available to make a decision. And that maybe that decision is a non-decision for now. But at the end of the day, it's the president's choice. It is not the decision of a military leader. to make what we do. They are giving him options. It's up to the president to make that commander-in-chief decision.
Jeannie, I don't know how often you're on the same page as Tom Massie, but he is among a group of Republicans on Capitol Hill who are demanding that Congress be involved in this decision. The president obviously has great authority when it comes to dealing with our own national security, when it comes to the immediacy of whether or not to strike. But if we're talking about a longer term commitment here, when does Congress get the call?
Well, so far, they have not been very active. You mentioned Tom Massie, who is joined by strange bedfellows like Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who have indicated they would sign on to this resolution. And then, of course, in the Senate, you have Tim Kaine, who is promising to bring other Democrats along. It'll be curious to see if any of the more right-wing MAGA folks go along with him. So we're going to see strange bedfellows. And I think from the president's perspective, and you can see this, I think, in the truths from today, he would think best case scenario is that he compels Iran to give up, come to the negotiating table, and he doesn't have to make this very tough decision. Because for him politically, this is a very fraught moment. He has told people two things that simply do not reconcile together. One, I am Israel's best ally. America will continue to support it. Number two, we are out of foreign wars. I am heading for a Nobel Peace Prize. We are going to be America first. That those two promises are irreconcilable, and he is being called to the mat on those by those on the MAGA right, which is why you're seeing the vice president, who speaks MAGA, speaking to them on Twitter today and saying, give the president some space. He's earned your trust. He's only going to do what's in the best interest of the American public. But remember, the use of troops for that reason is the same defense every president of the United States gives. And Donald Trump made a career of attacking George Bush, Barack Obama, Joe Biden. I can go on and on, Hillary Clinton, for using U.S. troops on foreign soil for exactly the same reason. So he's in a conundrum. Best case scenario, he doesn't have to make a decision. But I think he's not going to get that. He's probably going to have to make it. And it's going to put him in a politically charged position.
Rick, where are you on Congress's role in all of this? How long does Donald Trump have to act independently before lawmakers need to have a say?
Oh, I think that historically, presidents have been given long lead time. Throughout the ages, presidents have been able to act in an offensive fashion. Bill Clinton intervened in the Bosnia War without permission from Congress. You know, go back to presidents like Nixon and others. So there's a lot of history to giving the president of the United States flexibility, especially in urgent situations such as this, right? This does not correspond with a debate in Congress that could last weeks. This is a moment in time. U.S. needs to act, and the president, I think, will be given plenty of leeway. Remember, too, there are a lot of bipartisan support for hemming in Iran. This is not just a Republican idea. A lot of hawks in the Democratic Party see this as an opportunity to finally rid the Middle East of the biggest troublemaker that we've had in our lifetimes. And so I think you'll find both bipartisan opposition to this, but also bipartisan support for anything that the president wants to do to end the scourge of Iranian troublemaking in the region.
Jeannie, when you hear the president's comments, particularly from last evening on Air Force One, we are looking for better than a ceasefire, he said. Better than a ceasefire, a real end. Which is why people are wondering if he is, in fact, thinking seriously about committing the U.S. military to this, to take part in Israeli strikes against Iran. When you hear talk like that, does that tell you that Donald Trump will make this decision today in the sit room with his military advisors, or that actually Iran will make this decision based on how it responds?
You know, I think the president probably is committed to where he wants to take this already. I think that's why he came back. I think that's why we're seeing the messages we are seeing from the president, the vice president, Pete Hegseth on Fox News last night. Sure, his mind could be changed if he gets some new information. But I think he knows where he wants to go, and that is where he has been a long time. Iran cannot have nuclear weapons. The challenge for him is he blew up the deal in 2018 that would have left us in a much better position than we are right now. And now he's got to make a tough decision. Yes, he hopes that Iran completely capitulates, completely surrenders. But you talk to Iran experts and they say, how can Iran do that at this point? In the future, they might. But at this point, how can they? Number one, they have lost faith in the president of the United States, Donald Trump, because they don't feel like he was being completely open and honest with them about the negotiations that were occurring. And so that's something he's going to have to overcome if he really wants a substantive negotiation with them on this. And number two, is he really going to backtrack on his no nuclear weapons for Iran? I read that truth to say that he really does want regime change, which many people do, but he doesn't want to make the difficult decision as to how you get there, and he may just have to in the next couple hours.
Well, that's pretty interesting, Rick, when you consider the options here. Donald Trump could simply let Israel keep hammering away at Iran and hope for the people to rise up, or maybe an alternate approach to eliminating the centrifuges. But as General McKenzie said, the Iranians are better negotiators than they are fighters. And I think he said they're bad fighters and great negotiators. Based on the history of this conversation, why should the U.S. even take Iran seriously as a credible actor at a negotiating table?
Yeah, I think that Donald Trump has always felt that threats and coercion are the way to go with the Iranians. Mm-hmm. He's probably more right than wrong. I mean, Frank McKenzie has got an enormous amount of experience dealing with the Iranians. But remember, too, the Iranians have a death squad, trying to take out Donald Trump for the assassination of Soleimani. I mean, these are not like That's normal right. negotiations among interested parties. I mean, you know, this is the strangest group of people you're ever going to meet with. Hey, we'd like to negotiate with you while we're trying to kill you. So if you have conditions like that, you have to assume that Donald Trump's going to use equal, if not more, lethal ways of dealing with the Iranians. And so I just want to, you know, this is not like negotiating a real estate deal. Right. You know, you've got a situation here where Iran does not play by any rules of modern society, and therefore they are now vulnerable to those who have the power to prey upon them. And at the end of the day, if you want a peaceful Middle East, you're going to have to deal with the biggest troublemaker in the region, and that's Iran. And Iran has been unwilling to contain their ambitions.
Jeannie, I've got less than a minute here. If the president decides to attack and he loses MAGA, can he win them back?
He absolutely could, but there might be a fissure there. But let's not forget, we just got out of Afghanistan. Who controls that country now? The Taliban. It is not just we attack, regime change, and we live in a peaceful Middle East. The president, the United States, all of our allies have to answer, what is the day after? What is next? What is this new regime you're hoping for? We need to hear about that from the president of the United States if he decides to attack. What is the end of this entire thing?
Great conversation with our great panel, Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano, Bloomberg Politics contributors. Thank you both for the insights.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
A lot to look forward to with regard to our special Fed coverage as well. That's tomorrow with the meeting getting underway here. And that's always our pleasure because Michael McKee is in town when the Fed gets together. The FOMC means Michael McKee is with us at the desk here, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent. It's great to see you. I don't know how bullish you're feeling or how bullish Jay Powell is feeling. We don't get a cut tomorrow or a change in rates, but we might start hearing some hints. What do you think?
Well, Wall Street should be looking for hints. Okay. The question is, how much of a hint does the Fed want to give them? And I don't think it's going to be a whole lot because they don't know anything either. We are getting a new summary of economic projections, their forecast for GDP, unemployment, and inflation. And then we get the new dot plot. Mm-hmm. Wall Street is kind of betting that they're going to raise the unemployment forecast and raise the inflation forecast, which would suggest slower growth, but not do a whole lot about it in the dot plot, maybe cut from two cuts this year to one cut, and essentially admit they don't know what's going to happen to the economy because we're all waiting on Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, about everything. So yesterday, or probably would have a couple days ago, asked you about tariffs. We have a massive geopolitical crisis that's unfolding now as well. Donald Trump's in the White House as we're talking to you, trying to figure out whether the U.S. should join Israel offensively against Iran. This is happening just as the FOMC gets behind closed doors. Does that factor into their decision making?
It's not going to factor into their decision making because there is no way to know what it will actually mean. We can speculate about what the U.S. might do, and we can speculate about how the Iranians and others in the Middle East might respond. But other than oil prices going up, which is sort of a given in this situation, there's no way to know how this would play out for the U.S. economy, which is what the Fed cares about. Oil prices can go up. They will maybe at some point affect people's purchasing decision-making. But for right now, they have to watch, too. I mean, maybe they'll have a TV set watching you in the Fed meeting.
We'll see about that. If anyone knows, it would be you. But in this case, I mentioned tariffs. A weaker than expected reading on retail sales today. This is something the Fed can get its arms around. Is that a result of the front loading or the front running that we saw ahead of tariffs taking effect?
It largely was, in the sense that most of the damage was done by a decline in car sales because everybody bought cars earlier.
I see.
Building materials, maybe a little bit tariff related, but probably a lot weather related. It's rained. It just keeps raining.
Wow.
Then you had gasoline prices go down.
Uh-huh.
Gasoline prices are going back up again now because of what's going on in the Middle East. So it isn't clear exactly what the message is from all of that, except that the Fed has to keep an eye on whether Americans want to keep spending.
Sure.
But the Americans are waiting for details as well. And the interesting thing about getting all this information from the Fed tomorrow is July 9th, you know, 2 weeks after that, we hear about the reciprocal tariffs, and that might change the whole game again.
Unless, of course, there's an extension.
They put an expiration date on their new forecast.
Yeah, well, I guess 2 weeks is a pretty long time around here. So imagine yourself in the news conference tomorrow, as you will be, and I know you're probably crafting some impossible-to-answer question as we speak. What's the tone, what's the posture for Jay Powell in the midst of all this uncertainty? Is it just like the last news conference?
I think so. I think he wants to avoid making news as much as possible. He'll say that we are focused on the economy and we will take in all of the president's policies in terms of what they mean for the economy and for our mandate. And we just don't have enough information now to decide. And he'll kind of leave it at that because there's no percentage in him making the president mad. We already know the president is mad at him. And there's no percentage in upsetting Wall Street at this point because there's plenty of other things that Wall Street has to worry about.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of other things that Donald Trump has to worry about as well. You wonder if we don't get the missives on Truth Social tomorrow because we actually do have an international crisis underway.
Yeah, I suspect that we might not, but it could be overnight that he sends out some note that I don't expect too late Jay to, you know,
whatever he
calls him, right?
Too late, Powell. Is Scott Bessent the next Fed chair?
My guess,
what do you make of this conversation?
My guess would be no. I think
where did this come from this week?
Well, it's the Wall Street game.
Yeah.
You float people's names and see what the reaction is, and the reaction has not been overwhelmingly, yeah, we got to have him. And Bessent is kind of busy with a whole bunch of other things
like
for the president at this point, and it is easier for the president to imagine another Fed chair, someone like Kevin Warsh, who he's already touted as a potential Fed chair, than to come up with another name for Treasury who would be able to fit into the roles that Bessent has played.
Yeah.
Liaison to Wall Street,
right.
A negotiator with foreign countries in terms of trade and things like that. I mean, they're perfectly qualified people, but they also have to satisfy the MAGA side of the party. So it'd be harder for him maybe to get a new Treasury Secretary than a Fed chair.
That's a lot of needles to thread. You've covered this complex for some time. What do you make of all these roles that the Treasury Secretary is suddenly balancing? Did he even know he was going to be doing this?
Probably not. I mean, it seems to be an ad hoc process over at the White House, but this is not necessarily new.
Yeah.
During the Clinton administration, Bob Rubin and the folks at Treasury surpassed the State Department. They became the prime policy implementers for the president because we had an economic crisis in the world. We had the Asian financial crisis. And then we saw Treasury under George W. Bush with Hank Paulson also take the leading role once we had the financial crisis. And this is a time when the crises, now Israel, Iran may be different, but the crises that we have been facing that Trump may be causing are on the financial side. So it puts Treasury in the driver's seat in terms of implementing this stuff and in terms of talking to everybody else in the world.
Fascinating. Great to have you with us here. We'll connect tomorrow on the Fed. Michael McKee, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent, with us here on Balance of Power. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.